Spisak.
May it please the court, Mr. Ryan Valdez will argue for appellant. Mr. Daniel Ortiz will argue for appellee.
Mr. Valdez.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Ryan Valdez, and along with Michael Appleman, we represent Morgan Wolf, son of the decedent, Richard Glenn Wolf Sr., and a beneficiary under the decedent's will. The appellee is Sandra Gay Wolf, who I will refer to throughout this argument, and as I did in my brief, as Sandy. Ms. Wolf is the decedent's second wife, and they were married for 6.5 years before the decedent's death. We are appealing the probate court's award of a family allowance to Sandy under Texas Probate Code Sections 286 through 288. Section 286 allows a surviving spouse to ask the court to fix a family allowance in an amount sufficient to maintain the surviving spouse for 1 year after the date of the decedent. Section 287 requires any such allowance to be fixed with regard to the facts and circumstances then existing and those anticipated to exist during the first year after the decedent's death. And Section 288 states, no such allowance shall be made for the surviving spouse when the survivor has separate property adequate for the survivor's maintenance. In this case, Sandy filed an application for a family allowance under Sections 286 through 288 and sought $132,444. In support of her application, Sandy stated that her total monthly expenses were $11,037, and she argued that she owned no separate property adequate for her maintenance. The appellant objected to Sandy's application, but following an evidentiary hearing and subsequent briefing by the parties, the probate court approved the application in part and granted Sandy an allowance of $126,840. We have 3 points of error we'd like to bring up today. We believe the probate court erred in approving Sandy's application because it failed to consider and deduct 3 items of separate property that Sandy received during the year following the decedent's death. Specifically, it is undisputed that Sandy received 1, life insurance proceeds totaling $291,250. 2, the benefits of the decedent's IRAs totaling $121,000, and 3, income totaling $85,000. Taken together, these 3 items of separate property equal nearly $500,000, far in excess of the $133,000 Sandy claims she needed. Turning first to the life insurance proceeds, this court in Parker Square State Bank versus Huttosh, which is cited in our brief, held, and I quote, "It is established law in Texas where a husband takes out a life insurance policy, insuring his own life, and has his wife named therein as beneficiary, and where the premiums are paid for with community funds, then the proceeds of such policy received by the wife on the husband's death are her separate property." In that particular case, the husband has named his wife as the beneficiary on several life insurance premiums and paid for all of them with community funds. Shortly before his death, the husband executed a note payable to the bank and even went so far as to orally agree to assign the life insurance policies as collateral for that note, but he failed to do so before he passed away. Upon his death, all of the insurance proceeds were paid to the wife. The bank filed suit against the wife, seeking to subject the insurance proceeds to payment of the note. Both the trial court and this court of appeals refused to do so, holding that the life insurance proceeds were the wife's separate property. If insurance proceeds, whose premiums are paid for with community funds, are the surviving spouse's separate property and therefore exempt from creditors' claims, then the surviving spouse cannot and should not be able to claim that such proceeds are community property so as to preclude their consideration in determining the amount of a family allowance. Numerous courts have held just as the Fort Court of Appeals did, that is, that these life insurance proceeds are the separate property of the surviving spouse. And earlier this summer, in June, this court visited the issue of the family allowance in Estate of Rhea, R-H-E-A, it may be Ray. In that case, Justice Gardner, although ultimately awarding a family allowance to the surviving spouse, cited McCandless v. Devenport a case in which the Dallas Court of Appeals denied an allowance because the widow testified she had collected a life insurance policy in excess of the amount of the allowance, which is the same situation we have here. Thus, this court appears to have recently acknowledged what numerous courts have held over the years, and doing so now in the context of a family allowance, that life insurance proceeds are the separate property of the surviving spouse. As a result, under the plain language of Texas Probate Code 287 and 288, which again require that any allowance be fixed with regard to the facts and circumstances then existing and those anticipated to exist during the first year after the decedent's death, no allowance shall be made for the surviving spouse when the survivor has separate property adequate for the survivor's maintenance. Again, it is undisputed that Sondi received $291,250 in life insurance proceeds upon the decedent's death. This amount vastly exceeds the $133,000 she sought in her application. Thus, we argue that the probate court clearly abused its discretion in failing to consider and deduct the life insurance proceeds from Sondi's allowance.
But what if she hadn't gotten them until after the year was over? She still wouldn't be entitled to anything, even though she had no proceeds?
Well, again, I would look at the statute, and again, it doesn't say she has to have them then. It specifically says, look at the circumstances then existing and those anticipated to exist. That's the standard that the probate court had to look at. So, at the very least, she testified $291,000 is what I got, actually, at this hearing. That's what the evidence shows here. But even if she hadn't, if the evidence at trial or that the probate court had shown that it was anticipated that she would be paid $291,000 within the next year, that is the standard under the plain language of the statute.
I mean, it seems to me we sort of have to come up with a black and white rule, because otherwise there'll be gamesmanship going on about, well, when is the hearing going to be? Can I put off the payment of the life insurance policy for after a year? You know, I can see all these little machinations going on unless there's a hard and fast rule.
Well, and I think I understand where the court's coming from. With regard to the specific facts in our case, that is just a hypothetical, because we do have the fact that she had received the $291,000 in the record. But
my position is going to be that the life insurance proceeds became her separate property on the day of death.
And that, yes, Your Honor, and that's what the courts have held, including this Court of Appeals.
And therefore, it was hers, whether she got it a week later or
364 days.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that is the only way you can have a hard and fast rule, and that's why the law states it is separate property. It is a gift to the surviving spouse that matures upon the date of the decedent. And that's what has been the law in Texas since the 60s.
But what is the classification of the insurance policy right before death? Isn't it community property?
There is, I believe, in reading the Fort Worth Court of Appeals case and Parker State Bank, that what it is it is still deemed to be a gift to the surviving spouse that matures upon death. Even if it's paid with community funds. And again, remember, when we're looking at the statute, we're not looking at what happened before death in determining the amount of the family allowance. We're looking at the circumstances then existing and for 1 year after death. So regardless of what it is before the death, under the statute we look is what is it under 287 then existing and anticipated to exist.
But isn't a gift only as to one half? I mean, doesn't she already own half?
Of the proceeds? It's his life.
Of the policy.
I'm not sure I'm following.
The community bought the policy. The community paid the monthly or annual premiums on the policy. Right before death, it's probably a community asset, and she already owned half of it.
Okay.
So that would, to me, that would seem to make only half of it separate property.
Assuming that's correct, Your Honor, that still is $145,000 of her separate property, which, again, taking that situation, and I'm not speaking to it from a legal standpoint, but just looking at it, if that is the correct way to look at this, and it very well may be, half of $290,000 is $145,000. That would still be her separate property then, which is, again, in excess of the amount she has claimed for her allowance.
Was there any finding by the probate court as to what amount of money she needed to live on
during
the first year?
$126,000 is what the probate court said she
needed.
Okay. which it the probate court did reduce the amount.
Then existing on the date of death?
That's
then correct. Existing at the time of the hearing? Then existing when?
Well, Your Honor, the statute, which again is rarely cited, I was unable.
We don't have an overwhelming number of probate appeals.
No, Your Honor. Based on Justice Livingston's characterization, then it makes no difference. Because it's either if half of it is her separate property before death, that's in excess of the amount that the probate court found she was entitled to, and in excess of what she claimed she needed. And if it is then existing at the date after death, when it is her property, all of it is, let's say, then it's even more over the amount. Either way, it's in excess of the amount she claimed she needed.
And the bank filed its lawsuit when?
In the Parker State case, Your Honor?
In this case?
No bank has filed a lawsuit in this case, Your Honor. I was referring to the Parker State Bank case. I apologize.
Okay. I didn't see that.
No, I apologize. I was going through what a previous court has held.
So okay. To follow up, there aren't cases that tell us when then existing refers to?
I was not able to locate any, Your Honor. I was able to locate the case from June of this year where this court cited the Dallas Court of Appeals, which denied an allowance because the widow testified she had collected a life insurance policy in excess of the amount of the allowance, which is exactly the situation we have here. And again, that's the estate of Rea case.
Because if it's at the time of hearing, then we have game playing going on again. Do we want the hearing before we get the proceeds or after we get the proceeds? Whereas if it's the date of death, it's fixed.
Correct.
No game play.
I agree with Your Honor on that.
Okay.
But either way, I believe the allowance shouldn't have been awarded in this case, whichever way the court chooses to go. Second, with regard to retirement benefits, and again, the case law is not as concrete as the life insurance proceeds. That is the bulk of the amount that was awarded, that was received by Sondi, either before, on the date, or after, within the first year, and all of that's in excess. With regard to retirement benefits, this court in Churchill versus Churchill, while again ultimately upholding a family allowance, did consider the surviving spouse's retirement benefits, among other things, as separate property that was deducted from the total amount of her allowance. Here, upon the decedent's death, Sondi became the beneficiary of his IRAs, totaling $121,000. This amount should have also been considered and deducted from the allowance. And third, regarding Sondi's wages, which totaled $85,000, I concede to this court that there is a Texas Supreme Court case from 1889 that holds that wages should be neither considered nor deducted from a family allowance. Well, that case, Cooper v. Pierce is the name of the case. It's cited by Appellees. It has never been reversed. It has also never been cited for that provision, and in fact has only been cited one other time in 1931 and for a single procedural point that has nothing to do with the family allowance. We respectfully urge this court to break ties with Cooper, which is an antiquated case that does not take into account the facts and circumstances that exist in today's world where, unlike 120 years ago, both spouses now often work and have separate property, which can, should, and must include wages. However, we do acknowledge that there is a Texas Supreme Court case out there from the 1800s that says differently with regard to a minor. But it is, as opposing counsel points out, the same standard, whether it's a minor or a spouse. Your Honors, the purpose of providing an allowance for the surviving spouse is to furnish remedy in those cases where the survivor is left without adequate support during the year following the death of the spouse. Here it is undisputed that Sondi received nearly $500,000 during the year following the decedent's death, an amount that is more than adequate for her claim maintenance of $133,000. I'd like to conclude by quoting the San Antonio Court of Appeals from Noble versus Noble. A statute that states that a widow must be denied an allowance if she owns separate property adequate to her maintenance cannot possibly be construed to require that the determination concerning the granting of an allowance be made by considering only the condition of the decedent's property and the widow's needs and lifestyle without reference to the amount of separate property owned by the widow. It cannot be seriously argued that a court's discretion is ever so broad enough to justify disregarding clear and unequivocal statutory mandates. Section 288 of the Probate Code, in simple and unambiguous language, not only requires that the court consider the separate property owned by the surviving spouse as one of those circumstances, but in each case also makes such circumstance decisive of when such separate property is adequate to the survivor's maintenance. Where the survivor owns separate property adequate to provide maintenance for the survivor for a period of 1 year, the statutory mandate clearly requires that the application for an allowance be denied. Given that fact, it is idle to speak of a court's discretion. We therefore would ask that the allowance be completely abrogated because she had funds, separate property funds, that were adequate for her maintenance. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Valdez. Mr. Bakudas?
May it please the court, I represent Sondae Wolf, who is the surviving spouse of the decedent in this case. I think the facts are pretty well known in this case. They're pretty simple. I want to address what I think is the narrow, precise issue before this court. And, of course, we're dealing with the family allowance. And I do probate all the time. And the way we handle family allowances is this two-step process. The first step is to determine what is the necessary money necessary for the maintenance of the spouse for the first year. And that process was done in this case, and it turned out to be $126,000, as the court found. And that issue, that amount, has not been disputed. It's not before this court. The only issue before this court is the application of Section 288 of the Probate Code. And it's a very short section. It just says that there, you know, if there is any separate property, if the surviving spouse has separate property adequate for the maintenance, then there shall be no family allowance. Now, that statute has been a part of our books for over 150 years. There's very, very little case law on it, and the case law that's on it is not very clear about how that is to act. However, there has been some case law, and it has narrowed the issue of how Section 288 is to be applied. There's no question that it applies to the separate property that the surviving spouse had before the date of death. We're not arguing that. There's no question about that. Also, it is based on the Pace versus Eoff case, which is 1938 case, which is a Court of Appeals Commission's case that was adopted by the Supreme Court, held it does not apply to separate property of probate assets. And let me explain that. As the court probably knows, in the probate matters, there's a group of assets called probate assets, and there's a group of assets called non-probate assets. Probate assets are the assets that the surviving spouse, in this case, receives as under the terms of the will or by intestacy. And there was always a question how 288 is to apply to that section, because Section 37 of the Probate Code clearly says that title vests at the moment of date of death. So the argument is always made, hey, well, all these community assets that are part of the probate estate, at the moment of date of death, those become separate property of the surviving spouse. And so that argument was made in the Pace versus Eoff case. And the court in that case that looked at all that and looked at the purpose of section of the family allowance and said, no, that is not what the term has separate property in Section 288 means. We're not going to consider the probate assets that are going to be awarded to the surviving spouse, which are the surviving spouse's separate property at the moment of date of death.
Why not?
Well, because there are several reasons. And I think as Judge McCoy pointed out, it's uncertain about if they're going to get them, when they're going to get them, or how much they're going to get them until the entire estate has been administered. And just like my argument is going to be with the non-probate assets, we don't know, again, how much they're going to be or when they're going to be awarded, like life insurance policies. In fact, I've had several cases before this court about the issue about how much the life insurance proceeds are going to be, who they're going to be awarded to. We don't know those issues maybe for years after the date of death. So, again, that's exactly why the Pace versus Eoff case said, at least as to not probate assets, we're not going to consider those. Although they are, by definition, separate property of the surviving spouse, we're not going to consider those as either to deny or reduce the family allowance. Again, Pace versus Eoff says, we're only going to look to those separate property assets that the surviving spouse has at the date of death, because it's certain. We know that they have those. Don't know whether they're going to have these assets later on or not.
Is the commission, you probably won't know this, but I know I don't, is the Texas Commission of Appeals decisions binding on Court of Appeals?
Yes, I believe they are. I think if they're adopted or something, they have the same force and effect as a Supreme Court decision, but even if they're not, they are binding on the lower courts. And again, that case has been cited many, many times and has been upheld for that issue. So the narrow issue before this court is whether or not the non-probate assets are going to be treated the same as the probate assets. And I disagree with counsel. I believe there's several cases on point
regarding this issue, and that is the Barnett versus Barnett case, the 1998 case coming out of the Court of Appeals in Houston. Now, that case dealt with a whole lot of issues besides the family allowance, but it also dealt with retirement benefits. Now, that case was reversed by the Supreme Court, but in the Supreme Court's opinion, they specifically affirmed the Court of Appeals' opinion on the family allowance. And in that case, they talked about life insurance policies, they talked about annuities, they talked about wages, everything that's before our court. And in the Court of Appeals' decision, they said, no, that is not the separate property that's included in Section 288 that's going to reduce the family allowance. Now, I will admit, it wasn't an extensive discussion in that opinion, but there it is. It was clearly stated. They were not going to include those assets to reduce the family allowance. And again, that part of the opinion was not reversed when it was in the Supreme Court. In fact, it was specifically affirmed by the Court of Appeals.
I thought you were just about to talk about non-probate assets. Did you? And I didn't understand it.
That's correct. That they dealt with non-probate assets in the Barnett case. There was a monthly annuity, which is a non-probate asset. They talked about a beneficiary of a savings plan, which is a non-probate asset. Now, they also talked about wages, too, but that's an issue in our case, too. But they talked about all those issues in the Barnett case. And again, I will admit, it was an extensive discussion by the Court of Appeals, but they did say that that was not the separate property of the surviving spouse. Almost quote right out of the Court of Appeals decision, and the Supreme Court specifically affirmed that part of the decision. So again, although it didn't go into discussion of why we're doing this, but again, the Barnett case, the Houston Court of Appeals specifically said we're not considering those things as separate property of the surviving spouse to reduce the family allowance. So again, it's clear that probate assets are not included to reduce the family allowance. I think by the Barnett case, although I will admit it was an extensive discussion, clearly held that the same arguments apply to non-probate assets. Let's talk about wages. Again, as counsel mentioned, there is the old Supreme Court case that said specifically wages are not to be included in reducing the family allowance. And again, I disagree with counsel. The Barnett case specifically addressed wages too. In the Barnett case, the surviving spouse got a salary of $10 an hour for a full-time work. And again, the Court of Appeals in Houston said that was not to be used. It was not separate property to reduce the family allowance. And again, I will admit there was an extensive discussion, and I probably said everything that the Court of Appeals said in that decision about it. But again, when it went up to the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court did not reverse it and specifically affirm the Court of Appeals' rulings on the family allowance.
You don't think that the language in 287 that talks about facts and circumstances then existing and those anticipated to exist includes her assets and income that she will get in addition to whatever circumstances may come into play to determine the amount of the family allowance? I mean, are you saying this language is just looking to determine the amount?
Correct. Exactly. And that's how we've always
calculating the amount has to do with what she's got or going to get. I mean, that you've got to calculate what she's going to need subtracted from what she's got, or it kind of seems to me what she's going to get. No?
Well, again, that goes back to the first point we're talking about. It's a two-step process. The first step is, what are her needs? What are her expenses? And we do this. We set up a budget. What was the budget prior to the date of death? And is that budget anticipated to exist after date of death? So we go through the laundry list of things. What are the utilities? What are the mortgage payments? What are this? What are that? And we add them all up. That's the first step. And I believe, and that's how we've always applied Section 287, that's what 287 applies to. What are the expenses to anticipate for the first year?
Okay.
And then 288 comes in afterwards and says, okay, once you determine that amount, if the surviving spouse has separate property, and it says has separate property, it doesn't say may have separate property or anticipated to have separate property. 288 specifically says if the surviving spouse has separate property necessary to meet what the amount the court had determined.
So what is your position on the has of the date of death, or has as of the date of the hearing?
Has as the date of death. And again, as you point out, I 100% agree with you, because if it is anything else, I'll just hold off. And first of all, I'll have that hearing, because under 286, you can have the hearing, in theory, on the date of death. Or, you know, and then you can say, Judge, well, I don't know whether she's going to get this life insurance policy. You know, there may be some issues there. I don't know. You know, I don't know whether she's going to get this annuity within the first year. She may or may not. I don't know whether she's going to continue working or whether she's going to get fired or not. I don't know. Again, if this court rules that that's the way it happens, that's what I'm going to do from now on. I'm going to go run in there on the date of death and file for that family allowance and have the hearing. Or, you know, we may, you know, not that I would do it, but maybe other people would argue, you know, tell the insurance companies, hey, you know, just kind of put that on the back burner, you know, wait until after the, you know, 1 year has passed by. It just creates all kinds of problems. And then one of the things, as Justice Livingston knows, because we spoke on this, on issues of matters that are appealable in probate matters. And the awarding of the family allowance is an appealable matter, which means you've got to appeal within 30 days or it becomes a final order, regardless of how long the estate stays open. So what happens in this situation? Okay, we go in, we get a family allowance, and we say, well, we think we're going to get this life insurance policy, and of course that reduces or eliminates the family allowance. What happens if they don't get the insurance policy? You get a final judgment, we can't come back in, we can't argue. Well, Judge, we're sorry, we thought we were going to get it, we don't get it now. And the same with the annuity payments. We don't, you know, when you get a judgment, it becomes final, you don't get the annuity payments. What about wages? And all this is the same thing. I think that's why the Supreme Court in the Barnett case says we're not going to include those things, because, first of all, you're going to require the surviving spouse to get a job? No, I don't think you can do that. But what if the surviving spouse loses their job the day after the hearing on the family allowance, or 30 days after the day it becomes final? We go back in, we can't go in. It's a final order. I think that's why. I think, if you look at all these cases, it's the issue of creating certainty. At the date of death, yes, we know what separate property the surviving spouse has. And if the surviving spouse has separate property, as the statute says, 288 says, if the surviving spouse has separate property, yes, it will reduce, or in fact, it's kind of funny because Section 288, if you read it literally, although the way we apply it in probate matters, it's kind of like, hey, you can reduce the family allowance, although that's not really available in Section 288, but that's the way we've always treated it. But, you know, I think that's what the law is created for, some certainty, and to avoid gamesmanships and uncertainty of the future. So I think those are the two options for this court to decide. And relating to probate assets, the courts have clearly made that determination. We are not going to treat probate assets, even though those are separate property of the surviving spouse. We're not going to treat those. I think the courts, especially the Barnett case, have clearly held the non-probate assets, although I will admit there wasn't an extensive discussion, but I think the same reasoning applies. Therefore, we believe that Judge Virgil was correct in his ruling in awarding the family allowance, and we ask the court to affirm that.
That it's what the surviving spouse has as of the date of death. This court in Parker St. Bake has said that proceeds, life insurance proceeds, are the separate property as of the date of death of the surviving spouse. Okay. In the estate of Ray case from June of this year, this court said that in a case where the trial court awarded a decedent's widow an allowance of $250, the Court of Appeals reversed the award because the widow testified that she had collected a $989 life insurance policy upon the decedent's death. Thus, the widow's testimony showed that she possessed funds far in excess of what the trial court deemed necessary for her maintenance. That's 2 months ago from this court. With regard to the Churchill case, which is another case out of this court, Churchill would seem to indicate that, quote, then existing means at the time of death, but it also finds that what exists during the first year is relevant too, which is consistent with the statute, which says it's not only the circumstances then existing, but those anticipated to exist. It is the whole condition of the estate anticipated
to exist. With regard to the Barnett case, we believe the Barnett case...
His point comes true about, well, the anticipation. It didn't rain after all, you know.
Your Honor, we have an evidentiary hearing on this, and it is. If the surviving spouse doesn't want to work, that's the point of the evidentiary hearing.
It turns out it was a suicide, not a natural death, and so there are no life insurance benefits.
Your Honor, we could play the hypothetical game on this to the end of it. We've got a statutory mandate. It has to be, there has to be some sort of black and white rule here. Otherwise, it's gray forever. The black and white rule, which this court has acknowledged, is as of the date of death. What do they have? And this court has also acknowledged that life insurance proceeds are the separate property as of the date of death of the surviving spouse, regardless of whether they're paid with community funds or not. But even under Justice Livingston's hypothetical, if half of the policy belongs to the surviving spouse anyway, before death, then there's $145,000 out there, which again exceeds the amount that was claimed by Sondy in her application.
What about his point that probate assets don't count?
Your Honor,
according to that, in fact, it's quoted.
That's the Houston Court of Appeals case, and I would refer the court to the Fort Worth Court of Appeals cases, which say differently. In particular, the June 2008 in estate of Ray case.
Texas Commission Appeals, or whatever that court was back in the 30s, we concluded the phrase separate property is used in 288 does not mean the surviving wife's interest in the community property of herself and the deceased husband.
Well, if that's true, Your Honor, then it's not community property as of the date of death. If you go as of the date of death, long-standing Texas law says life insurance proceeds are separate property as of the date of death, so that doesn't come into play. Section 288 of the probate code says that you have to consider not only the separate property owned by the surviving spouse as one of the circumstances, but also makes such circumstance decisive when separate property is adequate to the survivor's maintenance. You have to look at all that. This is not a situation where you have a surviving spouse who is destitute, who isn't able to care for themselves, which is the point of the family allowance. You have a situation here where the surviving spouse received over $500,000 within the year following the decedent's death, and now she's asking for another $130,000. For the reasons stated in our brief and the argument today, we would ask the court to find that the probate court erred in failing to consider and deduct from the allowance the life insurance proceeds, the IRA benefits received by Sondy, and the income earned and to be earned by her during the decedent's death, which equals $500,000. Accordingly, we'll ask this court to reverse and render judgment based on the evidence before it that Sondy is not entitled to receive any family allowance. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Valdez. Mr. Bakutis, we appreciate your arguments and your briefing for today. Your case is submitted and you're excused.
So are we.
We're going to take a 5-10 minute recess and then we'll pick up with case number 3 on our docket.
All rise.